It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. Despite the urban unrest that has garnered national headlines in recent weeks, many people are still choosing to live in cities as opposed to suburbs. What factors need to be in place for residents to coexist and even thrive in a happy city? Today, we're putting that question to urban experimentalist Charles Montgomery. He's author of the book Happy City, an exploration of how different things impact a city's happiness and the ability of community members to connect with each other. He joins us by phone. Charles Montgomery, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh.
Thanks so much for having me.
And Mr. Montgomery will be speaking on Thursday of this week at the Inspire Speaker Series from 5 to 8 p.m. at the Kauffman Center at the Hill House, featuring Charles Montgomery and Chris Koch, who is also with us here in studio. Chris Koch is CEO of Pittsburgh's Design Center, a local organization dedicated to design, urban planning, and public policy. Chris Koch, good to have you with us.
Thank you for having me.
And we'd like to hear from you. What are the things that make Pittsburgh a happy city for you? And if you're not happy with Pittsburgh, what do you think is missing? You can join the conversation at 412-246-2002. That's 412-246-2002. Email is esspgh at wesa.fm, on Twitter at esspgh. And again, the number 412-246-2002. Charles Montgomery, how do you define a happy city?
Well, look, the first thing you need to ask yourself if you're talking about happiness in policy or in cities is, well, what do you mean by happiness? And, economists have been telling us for centuries that the secret to happiness is to get rich and be able to buy lots of things. And we're realizing in the past couple of decades that, well, that's only partly true. Getting rich is good, but happiness is a complicated thing. And just to simplify the conversation so I don't talk at you for hours, it's important to note that the most important ingredient for human happiness is social connectedness, positive experiences with family, with friends, and even high levels of social trust for other people in the city. So the happy city is most of all a social city.
So I was going to ask you what factors contribute to making a city happy. You're saying it's socialization. You're saying people getting along with each other.
Essentially, I mean, people who are socially connected, they're more productive at work, they get sick less often, they recover more quickly from disease, their communities are more resilient, and they live up to 15 years longer than people who are socially disconnected. And guess what? You can correlate the city's GDP growth and creativity by the number of face-to-face encounters the city facilitates. So it's not just about, I'm talking happy cities, it's not just about unicorns and rainbows. It's about everything that matters most to us. And we're talking about the good life.
In your opinion, what are the biggest challenges facing cities today, like Pittsburgh?
Well, it's funny. The biggest challenge you have faced in the past 60-odd years is this flight of wealth and people out to the dispersed auto-centric environment surrounding your cities, right? Some people call it sprawl, but let's just call it auto-dependent suburbia. I think the challenge now and in the future for cities like Pittsburgh is the fact that people with money and means, they want to come back to the central city now. So A, how are you going to find room for them? And B, how are you going to ensure that the people who have been living in central cities aren't pushed out?
Do you have any answers to those questions? I mean, how do you make room for people if there's a shortage of housing and you have only so much space to work with? What do you then do? If you're encouraging people to come back, you've got to have places for them to live, right? So how do you address that challenge?
No, and this is an issue. This is an issue in good cities around the world, cities where people want to live. I can tell you some solutions that we've pursued here in Vancouver, Canada. We've realized we actually have a lot more room in the city than we thought. Where is all that room? Well, often it's on a single-family home lot. So here in Vancouver, on every single-family home lot, the owner is allowed to build a legal suite in the basement to rent out, and they're also able to turn their garage into a cottage to rent out. So in other words, every single family lot now has room for three households legally, And so basically we're re-inhabiting neighborhoods that were emptied out by the shrinking of family sizes over the past few decades. That's one idea.
Yeah, I'm thinking that it's terribly unfair that you're speaking to us from Vancouver, being in a place like that might skew your perspective a little bit on the idea of living in a city, wouldn't it? Just from the topography alone?
Oh, come on. You guys have a beautiful location. You're surrounded by beautiful countryside. You have your rivers. We made a big decision in Vancouver 35, 40 years ago when you Americans were wrapping your cities in urban freeways, sucking the life out of your central cities. Poor people in an inner suburb in Vancouver, the Chinese community, said, no way will you put a freeway through our neighborhood and rip it in half. No way will you abuse us like that. So we said no to urban freeways, and so our downtown, it never died. It's been strong through the last few decades, and in fact growing. So, we have nice mountains, we have nice ocean, but the reason Vancouver's great is because we never gave up on our downtown.
Well, we haven't given up on our downtown necessarily either, although it could use some help. And Chris Koch, I want to bring you into the conversation before we take a call or two here. Is Pittsburgh a happy city?
I think Pittsburgh's a happy city overall. I think there's always room for growth. But I think, when a million people show up to see a giant rubber duck in the river, I think that shows that there's a lot of happiness and people want to come to events and be connected.
Does that show that there is a lot of happiness or that they're desperately seeking happiness?
I think that shows happiness. I think that shows whimsy for a city. I think people, when they heard about the duck, thought Pittsburghers won't respond to that. And I think that we proved them wrong.
But you say Pittsburgh can be happier, right?
Absolutely.
So what needs to be done to make it happier?
Well, I think, Pittsburgh has pockets of neighborhoods that are definitely people-centric rather than car-centric, but there's a lot more neighborhoods that have not been part of that, and there are a lot of neighborhoods that are still very disconnected from places like downtown or even from each other. Our geography is always going to be a challenge in that respect.
Well, traffic is often horrendous here. And as small and relatively manageable as this city is, at times, on many days, it's a challenge just getting where you want to go in a reasonable amount of time. I think it's when we're at our worst and most miserable in Pittsburgh. Does that have a major impact on happiness? And if so, how do you address that problem? Chris.
Oh, sorry.
Are you asking me now?
No, I'm asking. Are you talking to me? No, I'm talking. I was asking that of Chris, Charles, but I'll get back to you.
Okay. Chris.
Okay, so how do you address that?
Yes.
I think, that's what I love about Charles's book is the idea that urban design can be a major solution in figuring out how to redevelop our communities, not only to connect them to each other, but to reconnect people to each other in their own neighborhoods. We've lost so much through vacancy and the loss of population. We have churches and schools and social clubs that are empty. There's a way to put those places back and to use our streetscapes for these opportunities, make places where people can meet each other and, take advantage of the social capital building that, can exist in our neighborhoods.
But what about this problem of just getting around this city? It is very difficult. I mean, it's a small city. It should be more manageable. The layout is and part of it is the topography, but still you end up waiting for inordinate amounts of time to get through traffic, to get places. And Charles, you were talking earlier about how Vancouver, they didn't put a freeway through the middle of the city. But here in Pittsburgh, there are people who would, in addition to Route 28 and 376, the parkway, they would like to see maybe some other artery that allows you to get in and around the city better. Is that a valid point?
Be careful. Look, we know that cities that have actually looked at the evidence and who are guided more by evidence than emotions are tearing down urban freeways and looking at other ways to get around. So, I'm not gonna go on about Vancouver. There is something you need to know about Vancouver, and that is that even though congestion has been getting worse in our city, commute times have been getting shorter. How is that possible?
Yeah, how is it possible?
It's possible because we've been investing in really wonderful neighborhoods where more people can live closer to their work. So people are moving closer to work. But in other cities around the world, the solution is not to build more car capacity, because if you build it, they will come, and they will, and you will be enabling more and more development on the distant fringes of your metropolitan area. Instead, you've got to look at providing other people with faster ways to move. I understand you're talking about rapid bus systems.
Mm-hmm.
Got to do it. But people need to be able to travel faster on the bus than they can in their car. This enables people to make a switch, have more freedom, have more options. And then also your rapid bus stations become attractors of business. You can create villages along those routes.
We've been talking about this in this city and in Allegheny County. And I can tell you that, you know, there are a lot of initiatives to try to get people to move downtown, to reinvigorate downtown. But if you still can't get to Oakland, which is where the University of Pittsburgh is, I don't know if you've been here, Charles. Have you been to Pittsburgh?
I've been floating around Pittsburgh on Google Earth.
So you haven't actually been in the city. The only reason I'm bringing that up is that one of the big headaches that people have here is trying to get up Forbes Avenue or Fifth, if you're on a bus, to Oakland, which is where the University of Pittsburgh is. It takes an incredible amount of time. Rapid bus transit, or what is it, BRT, bus rapid transit, would potentially solve that problem, but we're years away from that.
I think it's also... go ahead.
Go ahead, Chris.
I think it's taking more cars off the street. It's not just about living next to work, but, you know, downtown, we've increased the population, but you couldn't buy a quart of milk anywhere. You know, they just opened the first grocery market. So you have to have other services in the community as well. Even if people leave for work, maybe they stay for other reasons. But most of our neighborhoods don't have, you know, any of those services, and you have to get in a car to do most of your life, you know, everything in your life.
Right. Well, there's that, and then there's also another reason to get them out of their car is that there's another easier way to get around, and that's public transportation, if it's built right. Let's take some calls. We're talking about the Happy City idea. It's an idea that Charles Montgomery, our guest, has written about. He's author of the book Happy City. We'll talk about some of the experiments he's done and also ideas he and Chris Koch have for Pittsburgh. Chris Koch is here as well, and he is CEO of Pittsburgh's Design Center. Let's go to the phones, 412-246-2002. We have Noel on the line. Noel, welcome. How are you?
I am well. How about yourself?
Good, sir. Go ahead with your comment or question. Noel?
I am well, thank you.
Good. Go ahead with your comment or question, please.
I have a comment just to say that, in my opinion, a happy city is one where people can balance where they work with how they live and how they play. And public transportation obviously has a lot to do with that. And I am a resident of Metro Pittsburgh, and I find the complaint that a lot of people have is perfectly valid. Metro Pittsburgh has some of the country's worst public transportation.
I think you've just identified a real problem here, Noel. So, Chris, how far away are we from? I mean, there's been talk; people are very interested in it. There had been talk, and people have lamented the fact that when they, you know, created the rail transit going from the South Hills to downtown and to the North Side, that they didn't, you know, extend it up into Oakland. But that, you know, that horse has left the barn, for lack of a better cliche. So the BRT seems to be the way to go. When is that going to happen?
They've actually just started the conversations about the Eco Innovation District in Uptown, which is the location of the BRT. And the study's happening right now to figure out how to do that. And it's not just about, as Charles said, how the bus goes up from Oakland to downtown, but it's the stations along the way and the way that it connects to the community that's very important. But I think for any solution, we have to have a multimodal solution. It can't just be a bus or a light rail.
What about what Charles said earlier, which is that you have to make these places along the bus line? It can't just be about getting from point A to point B. You have to create destinations or reasons for people to want to go along that route because, oh, there's a theater here, or there's a boutique there, or a great deli or a great restaurant, you know, shopping opportunities, that kind of thing. Am I summing up your idea correctly, Charles?
It's a great start. I'm actually interested in learning what Chris has to say about the opportunities for those solutions along your rail and also your potential bus rapid transit lines in Pittsburgh.
Yeah, I mean, you know, the BRT is looking at stations that not only are downtown in Oakland, but all the way through the uptown area, which is the neighborhood in between. I think, you know, the issue we have with the light rail is that most of the stations are downtown, and now there's a station that goes to the stadium. But, you know, for example, that station is disconnected from the neighborhood of Manchester. And Manchester is a growing neighborhood with a very good housing stock. Why doesn't the station easily connect to that neighborhood or easily connect to the north side neighborhoods so that people can access it? It's looking at the system, but also how the system connects to people walking and biking in other parts of the neighborhood.
That's a great point. Charles, go ahead.
Well, yeah, I just want to relate this to international studies. I'm going to tell you something shocking now. A study was done in the UK, and this is the first longitudinal, so a study done over time of people moving in different modes. And guess what they found? Even though for years we found that people who ride the bus, take transit, say they enjoy their journeys less than people who drive or bike or walk, this study found that people who switch from driving alone to transit got happier with their lives. So it seems like a shocking thing. How is that possible that you take the mode that makes, you know, that's less fun and it makes your life happier? Well, what they found is that every transit trip is actually a walk, then it's a ride on transit, and then it's another walk. So cities have got to do everything they can to make those walks in between, you know, at the beginning and the end of those journeys, a wonderful, comfortable, fun experience. And that means paying attention to the quality of your urban environment, building beautiful streets, lots of room on the sidewalks, beautiful trees, and especially ensuring that you've got the mix of uses along the edge, shops, services, and whatnot for people to pass through.
What other experiments have you engaged in?
Well, it's funny. Kind of on that note, we did some experiments in New York City and then in Seattle, looking specifically at the effect that street edges had on people. And in New York City, we actually
street edges.
Sorry, can you hear me?
Yes, I can. Street edges.
Right. So I'm talking about you're standing on a sidewalk. You've got a street on one side of you, and then you've got buildings on the other side. You know, so we were interested in the effect that building facades. You know, what is on that street edge? Are there shops and services, or blank walls? And what we found, well, I'll tell you about the Seattle experiment. We learned first of all that people claim to be happier in environments where there are small shops and services and lots of doors, windows, things to do. Right, so we sent people out in Seattle posing as lost tourists, looking as stupid and helpless as possible. And what we found was that in those active environments, again, with lots of little shops and services and kind of pokey environments, passing pedestrians were much more likely to offer help to our lost tourists who didn't ask for help. They just stood there looking kind of hopeless. Anyway, they were much more likely to get help in those active environments than they were in those environments with blank edges, like the kind of big box environments that we're now seeing coming back into central cities. So we found that, you know, a great streetscape with lots to see and do and lots of reasons to slow you down, it doesn't just make you happier. It may actually bring out the best in us. It may actually make us more pro-social.
And that's how cities used to be, right? I mean, years ago, and people in older cities, I'm sure, even here in Pittsburgh, would remember this, that's how it used to be. That's what you used to see around a bus stop, right?
Well, and you can have it again, but unfortunately, because of the overwhelming power of automobiles, you need to depend on your city planners and your developers to get those environments right, to get the zoning right, and for your planners to make demands on developers. So they pay careful attention to mix and detail.
412-246-2002 to join our conversation with Charles Montgomery and Chris Koch. Let's go to Ann in Friendship, who's been waiting patiently. Ann, welcome. How are you?
Good. How are you?
Good, thank you.
I live in Friendship. I have wonderful bus access. What I'm concerned about is happiness, the opportunity for all to be happy. I had spoken to a businesswoman in East Liberty who's been there a while. She was talking about the number of people who have had to be, as she said, put out from East Liberty into places like East Pittsburgh and Wilmerding. She talked about how if they miss the 7 a.m. bus, they're out of luck until 1 p.m. I know that you're talking about transit access. That along with other kinds of access to opportunities needs to be more equally distributed. I at one time worked doing interviews for surveys. One of the questions we asked people how they got to work. A woman talked about how she drives to work, but she would rather, she said if there were bus service out there, she would take it. She would prefer to do that. That's, one of the things where access to happiness needs to be looked at.
Well, when people talk about how preferring public transportation, oftentimes it's because your hands are free. You can eat a bagel in the morning. You can read the paper on your way into work.
She talked about congestion, though, and cost.
Well, there's that, yes, which we've also talked about here as well. And there seems to be a consensus, certainly, that public transportation needs to be improved and made more efficient. And you raise a good point. Thank you for chiming in. Let's go to Jeff in Oakland. Jeff, welcome. Thank you for waiting. You're on the air.
Sure. I want to push back on your comment a little bit earlier that Pittsburgh has bad traffic, because I just don't see it. I've visited major cities across the country and a few internationally, and traffic is so much worse elsewhere. So I feel like if you live far from where you work and you sit on the highway for a long time, that's on you. And I'm not sure how many public dollars we want to spend making it easier. I mean, I live in Oakland and I work either downtown or in the Strip District, and I can get there in 10 minutes during rush hour traffic. So I think there's lots of options if people want to not spend a lot of time in traffic.
But, all right, if at rush hour, are there enough buses available so that you can get from downtown to Oakland in a reasonable amount of time?
I mean, Oakland is a great place to take a bus. Unfortunately, in my situation, I don't take the bus, but...
So you drive from downtown to Oakland? You drive from...
I do. I typically drive to work.
That can't possibly...
My wife and I make a loop from Oakland to the North Shore to the Strip District and back.
Is that an easy loop to make in rush hour traffic?
It is. I can make that loop from my home in Oakland to the North Shore to my office in the Strip District in less than 20 minutes.
Chris Koch is shaking his head no. I'm going to let Chris address that.
No, I mean, it's possible. A lot of longtime Pittsburghers know some of the back routes that others might not. But I think, like a good example is it used to be really easy to get from, say, Lawrenceville to Wilkinsburg during around rush hour. But now that East Liberty is filling up and Bakery Square is online and filling up, that commute now takes maybe two or three times longer than it used to. So I think one of the things we have to realize is that the city is and is going to continue to fill up. And so having everybody be in a car right now that might be a 10 or 20 minute commute, it's going to soon be much more than that. And we don't want to wait until we have those problems to really start to look for solutions to some of these issues.
Well, and again, one of the solutions is the BRT, and we have Judy on the line from Pittsburgh, and she wants to talk about that. Judy, you're on with Charles Montgomery and Chris Koch.
Hello.
Yes, hi. You're on the air.
Hi. This talk about transporting white-collar workers from town to Oakland is absurd. They've been doing it all of my lifetime. I've lived in Pittsburgh for 70 years, and I got back and forth on buses the entire time. I did not drive. My question to you is, what are you going to do with all the displaced people along the way? Where are you going to house them while they wait 10 years for all of this to transpire?
What are you saying would displace people, Judy? The BRT?
Yes, it would. Yes, it would. The
would
people
it, Chris?
Who live in these neighborhoods are going to have to be displaced in order to make way for all these little boutiques and cute little stores that you plan to put in. Who's gonna deal with that?
Well, I mean, I don't know necessarily that that there are plans to contrive little shopping areas. But Chris, what about Judy's concern? Would people be displaced? Does she have a legitimate concern there?
I think you have to be intentional about making sure that doesn't happen and making sure there's opportunities for people that live in the community, near the community, to have both businesses and residential areas that they can stay in the neighborhood if they choose to. Uptown already has a very huge loss of population over the past couple decades. So there is a lot of open space there and a lot of parking lots. But I think any place you create this kind of opportunity, any livable community like Lawrenceville, even places like Bloomfield, yeah, I mean, people want to live there. So the market increases, which is not a bad thing, but you have to be more intentional in making sure that doesn't happen.
Before we wrap up this conversation, I want to get to something that was brought up earlier, and that is the issue of inequity. Inequity has been cited as a major factor in the troubles in Baltimore. New York Mayor Bill de Blasio has announced his progressive agenda, or is announcing his progressive agenda to combat income inequality. Does Pittsburgh need to take a good hard look at itself in this regard, Chris?
Absolutely. There's a lot of, like I said, communities that are already dealing with this. The population has gotten pushed out of places like Lawrenceville and the East End into areas like Penn Hills and, you know, the Millville, the Shaler area. So I think you have to make sure that you have the understanding of who lives in the community. Do they want to stay? And where's and make sure that they can either stay in the home they're in or have a place for them there. But there, you know, as a group that does design and planning, there are a lot of tools within that tool belt to help with that sort of situation.
And Charles, you know, how does inequity ultimately impact the happiness of a city? What have you found?
Yeah, look, we know that cities and countries that are more equal, where more people have the opportunity to share in the benefits of citizenship and of the city itself, are happier. It's very simple. So, I mean, obviously in the United States, you need to deal with that politically on a national level. But on a civic level, I mean, you can take inspiration from a city like Bogota, Colombia, where the mayor used a 3-year term 15 years ago to build more happiness. What did he focus on? Equity, providing more access to everybody. And an example out of Bogota is this. He wanted to make it easier for poor people to get to work. So they gave all the best, fastest roads to a bus rapid transit system so the poor could get to work as quickly as the rich. Well, guess what? After 3 years, everybody moved more quickly. So by focusing on solutions around equity, around fairness, everyone benefits. I think that's important to keep in mind.
We've been talking with Charles Montgomery, the author of Happy City, an exploration of how different things impact a city's happiness, and Chris Koch, who is CEO of Pittsburgh's Design Center, a local organization dedicated to design, urban planning, and public policy. And they are both taking part in the Inspire speaker series appearing on Thursday from 5 to 8 p.m. at the Kauffman Center at the Hill House, again featuring our guests Charles Montgomery and Chris Koch, hosted by the Green Building Alliance. Gentlemen, thank you so much for being with us. We appreciate it.
Thanks so much for having me. See you on Thursday.
Coming up, we'll look at the Spark film series featuring stories from diverse cultures to bring people together of all backgrounds. It's Essential Pittsburgh on 90.5 WESA. It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. Mayor Peduto's Welcoming Pittsburgh initiative is partnering with City Parks to present the Spark film series at this summer's Dollar Bank Cinema in the Park. The series is seeking to bring together Pittsburghers of all backgrounds and spark an engaging cultural dialogue. Joining us now to give us more of an idea of what this is all about is Betty Cruz, Director of Special Initiatives at the Mayor's Office. Hi, Betty.
Hi.
Welcome
back. Thanks for having me. Yeah.
And also with us is Chris Basher. He is Chris Basher, I should say, of City Parks. Good to have you with us, Chris.
Great to be here. Thanks for having me.
What was the, forgive me, spark behind the spark that created this series?
The film Refugees of Shangri-La was first shown in Pittsburgh last fall to a small audience in Oakland, and I had the chance to see it and seeing what a powerful and relevant film it is, given our growing Bhutanese community. We have roughly around 4,000, 5,000 Bhutanese community members in our area, and seeing what an opportunity it presented to share their story and hopefully elevate this to a wider audience than who was there in that one night, one opportunity. Just seemed like an opportunity we should take advantage of, especially as we're looking to build a more welcoming experience. And that's when I called up Chris and said, hey, would you be interested in expanding cinema in the parks so that it has more of this cultural engaging element to it?
Chris Basher, what kinds of opportunities does this film series create?
There's an abundance of opportunities, really. What we normally try to do is at least feature one film. And working with Betty now, we have six. And we try to hit all kinds of different notes in different communities, from the African-American community to the Mexican community to the Bhutanese community. And basically, we put together a series that kind of hits all those notes and really offers something for everybody.
So what kind of titles are you bringing in? Betty mentioned one there. And mm-hmm. What else do we
sure.
have to look forward to?
On June 10th at Flagstaff in Schenley Park, we're going to have Million Dollar Arm, which is basically about a sports agent who taps some Indian talent cricket players that come over and test the waters in Major League Baseball.
Story that has a Pittsburgh connection.
Yes, it does. And we're going to
explain that.
Yeah, the two brothers, they came over and auditioned with the Pirates and stuff, and there's the tie with the Pittsburgh sports there, and the one brother is actually still in the minors, so he's still here. The other one actually went back to India, but it's a very cool story, and people around here will definitely like the Pittsburgh touch to it.
And John Hamm plays the agent who
discovered
of Mad Men fame, so
very popular.
Famous actor there.
Yep. And we already mentioned Refugees, and that will be June 17th and 20th. And then we go on to Cantinflas, which is the story of the Mexican comedian film star who would go on to be very popular around the world in 80 Days.
No. Known as, I should say, back to Cantinflas.
Yes.
Sorry, I have
yeah.
to add my Latinas.
Didn't mean to butcher anything.
No. Cantinflas is known as the Charlie Chaplin of
yep.
Mexico.
The Charlie Chaplin of Mexico.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So how far back does this film go?
This is around.
So it's Chaplin-esque, but it's not the Chaplin era.
Right. I mean, it's early 1900s. Right. And then, you know, you see how he comes, and it's basically, don't change who you are for other people. Let people embrace you, because that was the big thing with him, is they thought maybe he has to be somebody else. But they embraced his quirkiness and everything else. So it's a great story.
And then there's also Cesar Chavez, which is a very different story. Also,
the civil rights activist.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Yep.
And, wasn't he the guy that organized the great boycott back in the 60s? Now, you've identified about a half dozen or so titles. Mm-hmm. Is there, in addition to the diversity, which is obvious, is there another criteria that you're looking for with these films? Because you really seem to have narrowed it down, so I'm guessing you have some pretty strict ideas about what you want.
Mm-hmm.
So, go ahead, Ben.
We do look at what's relevant also to the face of Pittsburgh's immigrant and growing community. But like Chris said, we also wanted to honor our African-American history, and it was important and obviously timely to show Selma. Since we are in the parks and it's a public opportunity, we need to be thoughtful of family friendliness and what's appropriate to show in which park. So where we're showing the different films was also a part of the thought process.
Yep.
And what response are you hoping to get?
Well, I think with the title, with Spark, it really is basically maybe some stories that people have an idea of, but they may not have actually taken the time to learn about these individuals and the civil rights stuff that they've really brought to the table and whatnot. And I think with the mix of films, some of them having some comedy, some of them being very dramatic, there's a lot of diversity just in the type of films they are.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that will in turn spark conversations and inspire the communities to basically look in their own neighborhoods and see how things that these people did affect day in, day out life of today.
Right. And I would say overwhelming turnout is what I'm hoping for even our already successful Cinema in the Park series, to really see a mass turnout from diverse faces that maybe aren't even aware that these city offerings are out there, but now they see a film that resonates for them, they come out, and it's not just for them, it's the opportunity to build these bridges between the native Pittsburghers, the new Pittsburghers, Pittsburghers of all backgrounds.
And what have you heard from people so far in terms of not only response, but if people chimed in with, hey, how about this film or that film?
I expect that'll come next.
Yep. I think after people see what we've done here, and the great thing about the Arbank Cinema in the Park is you're outdoors, you have that big movie theater feel, kind of with a drive-in vibe to it. You know, you bring your blanket and your pillow and enjoy the park. You can enjoy the skyline and everything else. But the great thing about it is I think after people see what we're doing here with this series, like Betty says, it will then get people thinking, oh, what's the next movie in the series going to be? What are they going to do next? So it'll be fun.
It is Spark, and it is a film series that is being presented at this summer's Dollar Bank Cinema in the Park. And again, the series is seeking to bring together Pittsburghers of all backgrounds to spark an engaging cultural dialogue. Sounds like you're well on your way to doing that. Thanks so much to Betty Cruz, who is Director of Special Initiatives at the Mayor's Office, and also Chris Basher of City Parks for joining us here on Essential Pittsburgh. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Hey, thank you. And be sure to jump on cityparks.net, and you can check out the full listing of films there.
So there's a whole schedule there.
Yeah, we have the full schedule online, broken down by site and location, and actually links from the movies where you can actually read about them a little more and find out a little bit more. And if you have any questions, feel free to call us at 412-255-2493.
412-255-2493.
Yep.
And we'll have a link to all of that information at our website, wesa.fm. Chris Basher, Betty Cruz, again, thanks for being here.
Thank you.
Hey, thanks for having us.
Coming up, business contributor Rebecca Harris looks at the options for where to stay when visiting the Steel City. It's Essential Pittsburgh on 90.5 WESA. It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. Coming up, business contributor Rebecca Harris. But first, each week, 90.5 WESA celebrates Inventing Pittsburgh. The series explores the city's lesser-known history, connecting its past to its present.
Six-year-old John Stanley is finally tall enough to ride Phantom's Revenge, a roller coaster at the 117-year-old Kennywood Park in West Mifflin.
It was like a hurricane because there was lots of wind.
Sean likes Kennywood so much, says his mother Sandy, that he memorized the park in the off-season, from layout to laser shows.
We get flashlights, we go in our kitchen. I have a disco light next to my toaster in my kitchen, and we pretend to be the Kennywood laser show.
Many people lining up on opening day share Sean's adulation, if not his style. 83-year-old Gordon Sowers has been visiting the park since he was one.
I come over during the normal season 20, 25 times. I just walk and watch the people.
For Noah Rhodes, the pleasures of Kennywood are similarly straightforward.
I just like going really high up in the air.
That urge to move higher, farther, and faster than you can in everyday life is where amusement parks come from, says Brian Butko, Director of Publications for the Heinz History Center and author of A Kennywood History. But having time to be amused was set in motion by the Industrial Revolution.
The world until then really had changed little for 1,000 years.
Our agrarian nation transformed into an urban, mechanized society at warp speed.
Suddenly, there was a consumer class with money to spend, making their money in factories, having more time than when you're on a farm.
Factories turned out parts, not just for necessities, such as trolley cars to transport the horseless, but for diversions. Imagine our society like children during summer vacation, rich with time and itching to do something.
Embodying all of that into one place were amusement parks.
In 1898, Pittsburgh Street Railways leased land from Mr. Kenny at the site of a popular picnic ground to build a trolley park, taking its name from the fact that it lived at the end of rail lines. The park featured a scenic railway that moved at 5 miles per hour, over gentle dips, and an old mill ride, Bucko says the park offended Victorian mores.
Amusement parks were seen as slightly immoral. You could dress more casually and be loud and drink, but human nature being what it is, that's exactly why they were so popular.
We've come a long way from the simple thrills of trolley parks. There are hundreds of amusements competing for our attention. So why go to Kennywood? Nick Paradise, a Verona native, is director of public relations for the park.
I think a lot of that cynicism that maybe we see in the 21st century, that kind of goes away when you walk through the door. That's, I think, why people are so passionate about it. It's not the glitziest park out there, but there's some charm here that can't be found anywhere else.
The Jackrabbit is Kennywood's oldest continuous coaster. And unlike most roller coasters, it doesn't start with a hill climb. Instead, almost right out of the gate, it drops riders 70 feet into a ravine, a thrill born of topography. The park has grown up with the city, so its visitors have never had reason to outgrow it. For 90.5 WESA Celebrates Inventing Pittsburgh, I'm Margaret J. Krause.
UPMC is proud to support 90.5 WESA Celebrates Inventing Pittsburgh. UPMC, life-changing medicine.
It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. From conventions to tourism, Pittsburgh has become one of the fastest-growing hotel markets in the nation. In addition to hotels, beds and breakfasts and inns are also providing accommodation options. This week, contributor Rebecca Harris, director of the Center for Women's Entrepreneurship at Chatham University, looks at the options for where to stay when visiting the Steel City. Rebecca Harris, welcome back. How are you?
I'm great, Paul. It's nice to see you. And when we hear that last story about all the different transportation considerations and what needs to be on the street corners, we have to think about the latest and greatest in Pittsburgh hotels.
So tell us a little about the Pittsburgh hotel market. And of course, you always like to start with the numbers. So right. What are they?
So one of the most important things that we want to talk about first is that in 2015, Pittsburgh was named as one of the top three in the world by the Condé Nast Traveler's top list of places to go. And really,
wait a minute.
I know.
Run that by me again.
Top three places in the world to go.
Based
on all the different criteria, such as things to do and things to see and innovation and tourism and developing economies, all these different things. So Cartagena, Colombia, Santa Teresa, Costa Rica, and then Pittsburgh.
I would never have guessed that.
I didn't do that poll. But on that note, and it's an editor's best travel destination. They do lots of best of. But
Cartagena, isn't that from Romancing the Stone?
That's
that Michael Douglas, Kathleen Turner movie.
Okay, let's move right on.
All right.
So this helps explain why the hotel construction industry is really booming. And also we have a whole dearth of conventions coming to Pittsburgh as well. Trying to book rooms and conventions and large banquet halls this fall and into this year has been really difficult. So at the end of 2013, there were about 25,000 hotel rooms in Western Pennsylvania. And we sort of, consider this DMA, SMA area. And this has been a 10% increase over pre-recession inventory, which was at the end of 2007 when things were really, slowing down and it was tough. And it's one of the biggest and fastest growing hotel markets in the country. And it's because of the conventions. It's because of travelers coming here. Pittsburgh hotels earn an estimated $600 million in revenue through last November that year. And again, it's much more than had been. In 2009, they were coming in at about $400 million. So we're seeing some very favorable trends.
And I understand we have some unique hotels in Pittsburgh because, there are hotel chains where you can, your hotel room in Pittsburgh is going to look the same as one in Cartagena,
right.
for example.
Right, right.
So what are some of the unique hotels in Pittsburgh where someone might go back home and say, wow, this hotel room in Pittsburgh was like none I've ever experienced before.
Okay, so this is what is very interesting. The boutique hotel craze is very hot. So boutique hotels, for example, the newest one that has just opened is the 248-room Hotel Monaco, which is in the former Reed Smith building. It's between 6th Avenue and Strawberry Way. And it opened in late January. It's a property from the San Francisco-based Kimpton Hotels. And here's what you can have there. You can have, in one room, for example, a green headboard. You can have a bedside birdcage chandelier. and you can have goldfish upon request. So that just gives you an idea, Paul. Right.
Why?
Why? Because it's whimsical, it's unique, it's different, and it's something that people want. It's not your same sticker room. You can't. It's, and every room is decorated different. There are themes in the different
There's
rooms.
There's research that shows that people dig this.
They love it. They love it. They love it. So that's a very interesting trend. Also,
what did these hotel rooms cost on average?
Right. I mean, the rooms can really vary according to the day and the week. Anywhere from, you know, you can look at $250 a night. You can, if you can find packages, you get $150 up to $400, depending on really what's going on in town.
Yeah, that's a little rich for my blood. Well, but somebody else, I'm sure,
well,
would enjoy that.
Well, but when you
that.
Think about what boutique hotels are, and that's really what you're looking at. And in East Liberty, the Hotel Indigo is set to open this summer. The Ace Hotel is scheduled to open in 2015 late. These are boutique hotels. There's a District Hotel and the Forbes Hotel, which are both downtown, also set to open in 2016.
I guess the big question here is, are these hotels, the ones that have already started up, are they doing well?
They are. The ones that have started up are doing well. When you look at something like the Fairmont, which is also a very unique hotel, it offers things.
In Oakland?
This is the one that's downtown.
Okay, right.
So the Fairmont Hotel is a very luxurious hotel, but there they have they're very sustainable. They have sustainable design and construction. They have earned a LEED certification in gold, which is the highest level. They also have a hotel dog. So if you missed your dog, you can meet the canine ambassador, Eddie, and you can take her for a walk. I guess it's Edie since it's a girl. And they also have cooking classes that they offer, along with just, you know, all your wonderful basic hotel amenities. There's the Priory Hotel. Do you know about this one? It was one of Pittsburgh's first boutique hotels. It was a Benedictine monastery. On the north side, it has 42 rooms, and it's owned by a family, and it's a very, you know, unique, and it's used all the old rooms that and renovated them. And then we have our bed and breakfasts that are very unique. When you look at something like Mansions on Fifth, which was one of the historic mansions that's been renovated, or the Negley Inn, or the Inn on the Mexican War Street. So we have some very cool and interesting and unique hotels.
We're talking with our business contributor, Rebecca Harris, director of the Center for Women's Entrepreneurship at Chatham University. And I was going to ask you what's trending in the Pittsburgh hotel scene, but I think
those are the boutique hotels, but and the kinds of hotels. But here's what's really important, Paul. The large trends in what we need in terms of hotel rooms is very important. So there could be a hotel project in the future for the Rivers Casino. And that's been a plan that was reported last year and some earlier this year, that the Pittsburgh Casino is working with its neighbors, the Carnegie Science Center and Riverlife, on getting approvals necessary to build a hotel on the site between the Science Center and the casino. Because if you think about other casinos, a lot of them have hotels connected to them, and this one doesn't. And I think they view that as a real need. The other piece that's very important in terms of trends is the city of Pittsburgh has hosted the World Series, the AFC Championship Games, the NHL Winter Classics, and the Stanley Cup Finals, but never a
Super Bowl.
You got it.
Ding. So do we have enough rooms to accommodate that? That's a big question.
It's very important. And so Steelers president Art Rooney II is looking into the feasibility of this. Now, one of the basic requirements is that you have to have, from the NFL, 30,000 quality hotel rooms within a 90-minute drive of the stadium. So,
do we have that?
Well, we are working on that. We don't quite have that yet, and we would need every bit of that, according to the CEO of the tourism agency, Visit Pittsburgh. And,
talking about having the Olympics here. How many more hotel rooms would you need for that?
Well, I mean, again, you look at from Silver Springs to Ohio to West Virginia, the 90 minutes. Now, New York was very interesting. They brought a cruise ship to house guests in the past for their Super Bowl, and Miami and San Diego did the same thing. So if you don't have them on land, interesting. But I think that's in terms of Super Bowl feasibility and having more hotel space, people are really looking at that.
So in about 30 seconds or so, which are the best resources for finding good hotels available to us?
I really recommend that people go to Visit Pittsburgh. It's the official tourism promotion agency for Allegheny County, established in 1935. And they really are dedicated to generation convention. They generate convention and trade show and leisure travel business. And they're a nonprofit organization, so they will definitely help you.
It's been an interesting chat talking
as
about
always.
Talking about the hotel market in Pittsburgh. It sounds like it's booming, and our business contributor Rebecca Harris sharing all of that information with us. She's director of the Center for Women's Entrepreneurship at Chatham University. Rebecca, as always, great thanks.
Thank you.
Tomorrow on Essential Pittsburgh, Pitt Law Professor David Harris joins us to discuss 10 policies every police department should adopt. Until then, I'm Paul Guggenheimer. So long for now.